I'll tell you what, let's pick up where we left off in the book of Genesis. We left off in chapter 34, okay? And for the sake of those people who haven't been here, just a way of brief background, okay? We're going through the episode where in the book of Genesis where Jacob has now come back from the land of Haran. He's coming to the promised land. He meets his brother Esau. We read about that last week, and he had a very terrifying experience for him because he had wronged his brother Esau, and he had to make restitution to his brother, and God protected him, and God provided for him. And now God basically had given him the commission to get into the promised land, but it seems like Jacob is kind of dilly-dallying around. In other words, God expected him coming to the land of Canaan, and he actually told him, and I think in chapter 31, to go down to your relatives. In other words, we know that they were dwelling down here somewhere around Beersheba, but apparently Jacob just stuck around up here by Succoth for a long time, and then when he crosses over, he goes to this city of Shechem. When in actuality, it seems like, I don't want to read too much into this, but I get the impression in reading this that God really expected him to go down into the promised land. And he kind of, you know, procrastinated about getting into there. And then finally, when he gets into there, he doesn't go to Bethel. And Bethel was where basically he made the commitment and made the promise to God that if God would protect him, God would watch over him, God would take care of him, and God would lead him back to the promised land, that he would make God his God and that he would give 10% of what he owned to God. He kind of made that promise, but he was procrastinating about getting around to it. And I think that when we read that what's taking place here in this chapter 34 and in chapter 35, I think we begin to see a few things that I think we can draw some spiritual lessons from, and that's, you know, when we procrastinate when it comes to God's will in our life, we can set ourselves up for some very, you know, disastrous things to happen. And what I mean by that is, I really feel like what's happened here to Jacob in this chapter 34, his daughter Dinah gets raped, and then his brothers try to take revenge for that, and it really causes a great deal of distress for Jacob. But God allows it to happen to motivate him, to get him going in the right direction spiritually, because it's that incident that takes place in this chapter 34 that motivates him to get down to Bethel. And Bethel means house of God. And sometimes in our own spiritual walk, we can become lackadaisical, we can become carefree, or we become apathetic, lukewarm, indifferent as Christians. And God has to do something to light a fire under us, doesn't he? 9 times out of 10, or I would even go say 99 times out of 100, a lot of people will not take God seriously as long as their lives are going halfway satisfactory with themselves. In other words, if things are going along, you know, at an even keel, and their life is halfway comfortable to themselves, it's so easy to forget God. And we are given a warning in the book of Deuteronomy, where God warned his people. He said, hey, listen, when you get into your promised land and you get all your fine houses, you're living in your fine houses, and you're raising all your livestock and your cattle, and you're accumulating wealth, and basically you're becoming very satisfied with your life, God warned him. He says, be careful. He says, take heed, lest you forget the Lord your God. And I look at this country today, and let's face it, this country is a country that has been blessed beyond measure as far as the material things that God has granted us, that God has blessed us with. But what have we done? We have gotten to the point where in our comfort and in our ease and in our materialism and in our wealth and in our pursuit of all of these things in this world, we as a nation have forgotten God. We've kicked him out of our schools. We've kicked him out of our courts. We've kicked him out of our institutions. We look at him like some kind of cuddly mascot. We don't look at him as an all-consuming fire that we need to bow down and worship and commit to. You know, this country has forgotten God. Why? Because our bellies are full, our pockets are jingling, and who gives a hoot about God? That's what it boils down to. Well, when we get to that point, a lot of times God has to send disaster into our life or allow us to get enough rope to hang ourselves before we get down on our knees and say, hey, Lord, I need your help. I mean, God is basically orchestrating all kinds of things to get our attention as a nation. I mean, look at the disasters that are happening. Matter of fact, the 90s have even been dubbed the decade of disasters. It's just staggering. It's just astronomical when we figure up the price tag that has resulted from earthquakes and from floods and from forest fires and from tornadoes and from hurricanes and on and on and on and on. These are all orchestrated by God to try to shake us out of our complacency and our indifference and our apathy and our love of the world as far as the lust of the eyes, lust of the flesh, pride of life. You know, this is what God has to do to us a lot of times. And so when we start reading this chapter 34, I think we've got to keep that in the back of mind of why God allows certain things to happen to Jacob. Because now Jacob, he really should have been down at Bethel. Bethel means house of God. But he's pitched his tent towards Shechem. And he's, you know, rubbing elbows with the Canaanites. He's rubbing elbows with the heathens of the land. So we begin with verse 1 in chapter 34. It says, "Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the sons of Hamor, the Hivite, and the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. And he was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and loved the girl, and spoke tenderly to her. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, 'Get me the young girl for my wife.' Now Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field. So Jacob kept silent until they came in. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. Now the sons of Jacob came in from the field, and when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very angry, because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing had not ought to be undone. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, 'The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage, and intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you shall live with us, and the land shall be open for you. Live and trade in it, acquire property in it.' Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, 'If I find favor in your sight, then I will give whatever you say to me. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give according to you as to me, and give the girl in marriage.' But Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father and Hamor with deceit, and spoke to them because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said to him, 'We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we contend to you, if you will become like us, in that every male of you be circumcised, and then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take our daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughters and go.' Now their words seemed reasonable to Hamor and to Shechem and sons, Hamor's son. And the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. Now he was more respected than all the household of his father. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of the city, and they spoke to the men of the city, saying, 'These men are friendly with us. Therefore let them live in the land and trade in it, and behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them. Only on this condition will the men consent to us to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised, that they are circumcised. We will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours. Only let us consent to them, and they will live with us.' And all who went out of the gate of the city listened to Hamor and to his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of the city. Now it came about on the third day, when they were in pain, two of the Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unaware and killed every male. And they killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword, and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went forth. And Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city, because they had defiled their sister. And they took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys, and that which was in the city and that which was in the field. And they captured and looted all the wealth and all the little ones of their wives, even all that was in the houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and to Levi, 'You have brought trouble on me by making me an odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and my men and my men being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my household. But they said, should he treat our sister as a harlot? Okay, now, the reason I read this whole chapter, rather than breaking it down or piecemealing it, is because we've got to get a kind of an overview of what's taking place here. Because this is one of the difficult portions of Scripture where I think a lot of Christians might have trouble with or difficulty with, because they look at this situation and say, my gosh, you know, these people were really ruthless, and they were really just, you know, just lying, deceiving, conniving, worthless, good-for-nothing people. Why in the world would God ever choose them? But I think that we have to back up a little bit, look at the situation from God's perspective. First of all, what we're seeing here, okay, God is allowing certain things to happen in Jacob's life to, like I said, to motivate him spiritually and to get his family motivated, all right? Now, remember, Jacob, his name means deceiver. His name means supplanter. He was a liar. He was a cheat. He was a deceiver. And God has been dealing with him for years and years and years. And, you know, and God had actually, you know, ended up wrestling with him. And he changed his name from Jacob to Israel. And I mentioned this before, that Jacob basically is all of us in the sense that we are all sinners. We're born sinners. And that's our nature. We sin because that's what we are. We are sinners by nature. I know that's very unpopular today. Okay, people like to think that, well, I'm basically a good person. Well, that is a lie spewed right out of the bowels of hell. Each and every one of us are born in iniquity in the sense that we are born with this fallen nature. We gravitate towards sin. By our very nature, we are selfish, self-centered, egotistical, proud, lustful, arrogant. The list goes on and on and on and on and on. If you know yourself, you know it's true. And that's why God has got to change our nature. There's no point in trying to patch it up and say, well, I'm going to turn over a new leaf, or I'm going to make a New Year's resolution to become more holy. That ain't going to work. We need to die to ourselves in accepting Jesus Christ and let him become Lord of our life and let him change us. You look at these people, you know, you see his sons. He's got two sons, Simeon and Levi. What do? They want to take vengeance because their sister got raped. Their sister Dinah got raped. But before we can get into that, back up a little bit, and it says that she's pretty young. She's probably between 16 and 18 years old at this particular time. But she goes out to visit the daughters of the land. Well, the city's named Shechem, but Hamor, who is the king of Shechem, has a son named Shechem. So it might get a little confusing here. But he sees Dinah. He says, man, I got to have that. And then he goes out and he rapes her. Okay? And then he decides, well, gee, you know, I really want this girl. So, you know, he tells his father, get her for me. I mean, I'm looking at this situation and I'm saying, well, look at the type of individual that Shechem is. In other words, apparently his father never denied him anything. He just says, hey, I want that. You get it for me. And his father goes diddy-bopping down to try to get whatever he wants. And I think that this is probably his problem to begin with. You know, you see a situation where he obviously has not been denied anything in his life. He's been given everything he wants, or otherwise he's going to throw a tantrum. And I think that you know, we can even see it in today. That, you know, we look around at a situation where people today, and unfortunately in this country today, there's just this growing, I think, sense or this feeling that, hey, I have rights, and I want my rights, and I want what I want, and I want it now, and nobody better stand in my way. I mean, this is kind of the attitude that we're seeing today, and I really believe that what that cultivates is a spirit of ungratefulness. And I've always felt this. I mean, if you see a person who's not grateful, or a person who lacks, you know, a thankful heart, to me, that really shows a smallness of character, doesn't it? I mean, it certainly does to me. And I think it really does to God. Because, you know, when we begin to take God's blessings for granted, you know, I don't care, you know, we could look at some of the most ordinary things, but can you imagine what life would be like without them? You know, when's the last time you ever thanked God for your eyesight, for example? You know, have you ever thanked God for that? Can you imagine what life would be like without that? Just getting out of bed and tying your shoe may seem like a totally insignificant thing. But do you realize how many paraplegics there are, or how many people that are incapable or they're suffering from some kind of something where they can hardly do the simplest task, and we take all this for granted? things that we take so much for granted. And we and how many people really thank God for what they have? What do we enjoy? What we, you know, instead we have this tendency to do what? We have this tendency to become dissatisfied. We say, hey, gee, you know, that we focus in on what we don't have or what we feel like we should have or what we really want rather than, hey, what do I have to be grateful for, to be thankful for? Even Paul ties in with the New Testament. You know, if we can learn the secret of being content, it's a learned secret. It's something that doesn't come by overnight. It doesn't come by osmosis in terms of, you know, you don't just wake up one morning and you say, well, you're content. You have to learn that secret. And it's very, very difficult for each and every one of us, isn't it? It is. Go all the way back to Adam and Eve. You got a situation there before the fall where they had everything. Look what Eve had, okay? She didn't have to worry about her next meal. She didn't have to worry about a husband cheating on her or leaving her. She didn't have to worry about a husband who didn't have a spiritual relationship with God. She didn't have to worry about death or sickness or dying. She had everything imaginable at her fingertips. But the devil poses one question, which creates what? A sense of discontent in her. He says, hey, did God say you're not to eat of that fruit? She said, well, God said we can't eat that fruit because the day we do, we'll die. And then he said, well, that's a lie. That ain't going to happen. He says that he knows that the day you eat that fruit, your eyes will be open and you will become like God. So he creates a sense of dissatisfaction in her, a sense of discontentment. Okay? Feeling like, well, gee, I really should have something more. And, of course, this is how the whole ball got rolling in the first place in terms of sin and all the consequences that are involved in that. And I think what's very significant is that she didn't have a fallen nature like you and I do. Okay? She had a sinless nature, but she sinned nevertheless. How? Because Satan was able to generate within her a sense of discontent. And if once they fell, then we all have fallen with them. And so it's so much harder for us to be content with what we have, right? And I would say this, we will never develop a sense of contentment unless we develop a sense of appreciation for what we have. You see this in Shechem, as far as I can see. This is a guy who just says, I want it, I want it, I want it, gimme, 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 gimme. And look at the situation that he's now put the whole city in. Okay? And his father, obviously, you know, appears to be somebody who never disciplined him the way he should have been disciplined, never raised him the way he should have been raised, because he's just going to give him what he wants. So he tells his father, go over and tell Jacob I want his daughter to marry him. So Hammer goes over to Jacob and then tells Jacob. Jacob doesn't know what to say. You know, he finds out his daughter's been raped, but he doesn't say anything. He waits till his sons come in from the field. They're tending the flocks all day, so they find out about it, and they're really angry. They're really ticked, and they want revenge. And they're going to get it. Okay, but here's another thing we got to keep in mind. What does it tell us in the New Testament? And it also tells us in the Old Testament. It says that vengeance is mine, says the Lord. And we're told, I think it's in Ephesians, but it says that never, never repay evil for evil. You know, we all have that tendency to want to do that, don't we? Mm-hmm. It's just inbred us to do something to get revenge. And it's so much to the flesh, but we are given a command never to do that. It's something you have to learn, isn't it? They say, never return evil for evil. The vengeance is God's. Okay? Because as soon as we try to repay evil for evil, the devil's got us by the throat, and it's just going to escalate, further and further. Well, here's a situation where the brothers decide, hey, we're going to take this into our own hands. And look what they do, of course. They kill all the males in the city. Now, I think what's kind of significant is this. This is before the Mosaic Law. This is before, Moses came and gave us God's word as far as what God would require. But in the Old Testament, it says, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a bone for a bone, break for break, a life for a life. Okay? That if you took another person's life, then you're going to have to pay with your own life. If you plucked out somebody else's eye, then you're going to have to pay with your own eye. And there's a lot of bleeding heart liberals today who just feel like, hey, this is inhumane. This is not right. But all I can say is this. In actuality, if you look at that, Old Testament you know, law or statute or ordinances as far as bone for bone, life for life, break for break, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, it's actually almost, you look at it from one perspective, it's almost puts a limit on what we can do. In other words, what I'm saying is this. These guys way overstepped their bounds. Their sister was raped, right?
Yeah, nobody was murdered.
And they end up killing all of these guys in revenge. First of all, it wasn't up to them to take revenge. But second of all, when they did take revenge, their revenge far exceeded the crime that was originally committed. So that's another reason why God gave us the law as far as eye for eye, tooth for tooth, break for break, bone for bone, to say, hey, this far and no further. But these guys way overstepped their bounds, didn't they? But look at the way they do it. You know, they do it deceptively. And I think that's kind of significant, because here Jacob has been, you know, all his life he's been a deceiver and he's been a liar and he's been a con man. And God has had to deal with him over and over and over with it. But look, it's passed on to his sons, isn't it? Isn't this, we are told in the Old Testament, where God told Moses, he says, I am a jealous God. And he says, I visiting the iniquities of the fathers upon, you know, their children and their children's children to the second and third generation. In other words, a lot of times a parent's sins will end up becoming a child's sin. And then they will pass it on to their children. You know, this is basically, what is it? It's reaping what you sow. You know, if your father is an alcoholic, or if he's a drug addict, or your mother is, chances are your kids are going to become the same way. If your father is abusive, chances are you're going to become abusive. If your father is a thief and a liar and a cheat, chances are you're going to be the same. Because it's passed on from generation to generation. And so you see it in his kids here, this type of, you know, deceit. But look at this, is to me, it's not just deceit, it's almost sacrilegious in its deceit, because they're going to use God to cloak their evil intentions of revenge. And how many people today use God for their own selfish purposes? I don't know how many of these televangelists have fallen into this, you know, situation where, you know, they're using God for what? For money, right? Asking for money, and they totally misappropriate the money that's given to them in the name of God to what? To live this extravagant lifestyle, to buy all of these, you know, different things. I mean, Mercedes-Benz and houses there and mansions there and this and that and the other thing. I mean, what are they doing? To me, that's blasphemy when you use God for your own selfish ends or for your own deceitful ends. Well, obviously that's what they're doing. But you take a look at Jacob's family. And what are you seeing here? When we read on further on, you'll find that there's murderers, and there's liars, and there's deceivers, and there's fornicators, and there's adulterers. And when you go all the way down, like when you look at the line of Jesus Christ, all the way down, you will find all kinds of riffraff. But what does that say to us? What it says to me, anyway, is this, that it shows God's undeserved favor. It shows God's grace towards a sinful, lost human race. That none of us are in a position to just simply say, well, God saved me because I'm good, or God saved me because I deserve it, or I'm going to go to heaven because I'm quote-unquote a good person. No. What we see here is how God is working through frail, you know, sinful human beings to save all humanity. And he's working through Jacob's family, in spite of them, to do what? To save us. Because it was a promise that he made to Abraham, that through Abraham, that all the nations of the world would be blessed, you know, through the Messiah, Jesus Christ, that all of us, okay, would have the opportunity to be what? To be saved, to go to heaven, in spite of the fact that we don't deserve it. So you can kind of see that unfolding as well. Anyway, what happens now is that the Jacob's sons, they convinced the men of Shechem to be circumcised. Like I said, using God, using this religion to cloak their evil intentions. They all become circumcised. It says on the third day, I guess they were still smarting as far as their circumcision was concerned, and so they were pretty well incapacitated. And then Simeon and Levi go in there and they murder all the men. I don't know, it may not have been a very big city because it was just two of them unless Simeon and Levi had their servants working with them. Okay, but they apparently were very responsible for this. Their other brothers apparently didn't know about it, but when they found out about it, what do? They all go in there and loot the town, loot the city, take everything, including the women and children as slaves. Okay, so you see a real deceitfulness, okay, manifesting itself in this whole family. And it manifests itself even in murder. Now, when Jacob finds out about it, he's panicked. He's saying, man, you know, you guys have made me an odious stench that all the people of the land are going to hear about this, that they're going to come down and take vengeance on us, and we're going to kill us all, destroy us all. Okay, but what does it really do? I mean, what it happens is it motivates Jacob. It motivates him to really seek God's face. And he feels like, man, we got to get out of here. And so now it motivates him to pick up, you know, and to move on towards Bethel. And like I said, Bethel means house of God. And sometimes that's what happens to happen in our lives, to get us motivated. In other words, to get a fire lit under us, spiritually speaking, so that we will do what? We'll begin to seek God's face. And, you know, the unfortunate thing, too, is that some people can have a fire lit under them, and they aren't going to do anything but just sit there. I mean, I've seen it happen, that sometimes God can send tribulation, and he can send distress, and he can send difficulties, and he can send trials or heartbreak or disillusionment, okay, where a lot of people would be motivated to begin to seek God. Some people, they're just unmoved by it. I think it's kind of interesting that, you remember when Jesus died on the cross, he had a thief on the right and a thief on the left. They were both under the same condemnation. They were both under the same sentence of death. They were both suffering, you know, almost unimaginable pain. But one died repentant because of the pain that he was suffering, and the other died apparently blaspheming, and he's still blaspheming tonight. So sometimes, you know, even though God may be dealing with us, it doesn't mean that it's always going to work. I mean, obviously, if you look around at this nation, how God is dealing with this nation in terms of sending judgment after judgment after judgment after judgment, and how many people are really, you know, motivated to change their lives, to turn to God. Instead, a lot of times, if they get hit by a tornado, it's like they shake their hands and fist in God's face and say, why me? Why did God do this to me? But they couldn't give God the time of day before it happened, you know. But God, in his mercy, is trying to get men's attention before it's too late. It's like what we're seeing here, we are on a collision course with an all-consuming fire. And every time God is sending us these warnings, they're like sirens or warning bells that are going out from heaven saying, hey, warning, warning, warning. You know, we need to repent. We need to change our ways. We need to get back to God and get away from our sins and turn ourselves around before it's too late, before we meet him as our judge. You know, and apparently, a lot of judgments that God's sending in our way and against this nation, it's going unheeded. You know, we're continuing to go on our reckless path, you know, and our reckless self-will towards destruction. I mean, it's obvious. Well, at least Jacob, he can see that, you know, he's in a very difficult situation, and he just, you know, begins to seek God in it. Okay, look, pick up where we left off in verse 27. Says, Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city because they had defiled their sister. Okay, but you see a kind of motivation here. Okay, Simeon and Levi, they killed all the males, but the others come in and they say, well, we're going to take everything that these people belong to these people because they defiled our sister. In other words, what I see here is a rationalization, is a justification, right? And I can say this, there's not one sin that you can imagine we couldn't somehow rationalize or excuse or justify. You know, there really isn't. I don't care, from incest to mass murder. We're seeing it today, aren't we? That people aren't really calling an ace and a spade when it comes to sin. You look at our president on the TV, you know. I mean, the justifying and the rationalizing, okay? And what was brought out in the paper was that you see a lot of people say, well, here's a situation where they got two people, quote-unquote, in love. Well, obviously, if you can cut through all the claptrap, you can see that obviously there's no love there. I mean, they're very much in lust, but not very much in love. But the interesting thing to me is they use the word love to what? Somehow excuse this. Somehow rationalize it away. Right? That's what I'm getting at. It's like there's no sin that we can think of that we can't somehow rationalize, can't somehow excuse. And obviously, from a divine perspective, from God's perspective, he's going to look right through our lying hearts and look right at the motives and call it for what it is. And that's what we need to do today. Unfortunately, we're not doing it. Not as a people, not as a nation, not as individuals, not even as a church. You know, I'm talking in generalization now, but it's very true. And unfortunately, you know, we get to a situation where, hey, we can justify anything we do, just exactly the way Simeon and Levi did. And verse 28 says, they took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field, and they captured and looted their wealth and all their little ones and their wives and even all that was in the house. And Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me by making me an odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and my men, being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I shall be destroyed in my household. But they said, should he treat our sister as a harlot? And I think it's kind of significant that Jacob, rather than being absolutely outraged and incensed at their crime, at their sin, he's saying, what's going to happen in regards to the consequences on me? And I think that too kind of shows, you know, something that's missing in Jacob's character that I think is an illustration to us that there's a failure on our part as a nation seems to get outraged over wrongdoing or over sin. You know, there's just a total lack of outrage, isn't there? And I really do believe that, hey, man, unless we have, you know, a sense of outrage when it comes to sin or when it comes to injustice or when it comes to wrong, you know, it's just going to run roughshod all over us.
I think to accept it. It's,
right.
It's the nature of things.
I mean, right.
Things like in Nazi Germany, I mean, there was, after a while, a lot of the things that the Nazis did, a lot of the good Germans just, it became the part of the day. I mean,
right.
You know, the course of nature.
Exactly. Well, you know, there's an old saying, the only thing needed for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's exactly where we are at today, that good men are doing nothing. There's so few people who are standing up who are outraged. You know, you look at what's coming out of the TVs. You look at what's coming out of Madison Avenue. You look at what's coming out of Hollywood. I mean, you know, I just know, there's no doubt in my mind, that if the overwhelming majority of people who claim to be Christian, now, you know, 96% of the people in this country claim to believe in God. A good 90% of those, or between 85 and 90% of those, claim to be Christian. If all those who claim to be Christian in this country would get outraged, for example, at some of the filth that comes out of the TV, you know what? All they have to do is turn it off in a protest, an outrage. And I guarantee you, within 1 week, they would change what's coming out of there. They would change it, just like that. Jesus said, hey, you're supposed to be the light of the world. You're supposed to be the salt of the earth. You're supposed to be the leaven for society. We're supposed to make a difference. But how many of us are making it as far as the church is concerned? You know? Does anybody want to add anything they want to share to what we just read here?
No.